Welcome, everyone, to episode 80 of Underserved. With me in studio today is Andrew Bauer, Senior Salesforce Architect at Publicis Sapient. Let's get started.
Welcome to this week's edition of Underserved, the podcast for the rest of the tech industry, where we focus on stories of tech industry leaders, their insights, and their lessons learned. And now, your host, Andrew Gelina.
Andrew, thank you so much for joining us today on Underserved.
Hey, Andrew, it's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Oh, what a great name, right?
Oh, it's the best.
So when you're young, like 12 years old, what sort of computers do you have around the house?
Oh, man, that brings me back. Huh? So when I was growing up, we had this giant gateway computer. It took up the entire under-the-desk space. So it's amazing to see how far they've come now. But that was the thing. We had that and the giant monitor on the desk there that you had to move it somewhere, and that was a workout. You know, you didn't have to go to the gym that day.
The CRT was like 20 pounds. The gateway, like, colored like a cow, about as heavy.
It's crazy. It's unbelievable.
Did you tear that thing apart at all?
Absolutely, yeah. And you had two little screws on the back and the whole cover slid off. I took it apart more often than my parents were happy about because it was the only computer we had for a while. And, you know, anytime I opened it up, it was gone for the week.
So you like tinkering. What else do you like about computers back then?
It's such an amazing way to connect with the rest of the world. You know, the internet was in its prime and you had all of these sort of new ideas coming out of, you know, what the web would look like. And you had AIM and everything else like that at the time. So it was an incredible time to really just see the development happen and see how fast things are coming together.
Yeah. So I remember like AOL and AIM, you know, true internet snobs would look down their nose on it, but they really popularized the internet to the world.
They did, yeah. And it was funny because one of my first jobs out of school at Boston University, our main way of connecting with the teams there was still through IRC. It wasn't until that point when I actually got into IRC and sort of everything there. So my first intro was absolutely through AOL.
So before you even go to university, are you like teaching yourself out of like dummies books or anything like that?
Yeah, I think we had a couple of them lying around. You know, I wasn't really a big one for following instructions or kind of going through there. So it was really just take it apart and see how it goes together and where all the different wires go. And a lot of those books kind of sat on the shelf. Probably could have taken a couple of shortcuts by reading through the books, but it was a lot more fun to play around with them and see what was in there.
I read Unix for Dummies in like the late 90s, and that was a game changer for me. It's a career changer, really. So you go to Syracuse University, you're an Orangeman. What's that like?
That was awesome. You know, I think there was so much at Syracuse. I went to the iSchool over there. So the information management and technology was the degree. And the school was this really interesting combination of business and technology. And we learned all sorts of different things that weren't computer science focused and weren't necessarily a typical business major or computer science major. So it was a fun hybrid there. And the campus gets cold in the winter, not too many days of sunlight in Syracuse, New York, but my dad prepared me for that. My mom and dad went to Syracuse too. My dad grew up in Utica. He said, you know, you're going to get only a couple of days of sun a year, but you know, it'll make you appreciate the spring when it comes around.
It sure will. Another underserved guest, Daniel Goldenberg, was an iSchool alum. He said it kind of had a entrepreneurial vibe. Is that how you felt about it?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, we had a really close relationship with the downtown. Syracuse was in the middle of sort of this rebirth of entrepreneurship, even in the downtown area, rethinking some of its roots from the Salt City into becoming a sort of tech hub for upstate New York. So there was a really close relationship with the iSchool, with that downtown corridor. A lot of startups actually were formed from the iSchool people. Me and my buddies actually, we started a startup called RentCuse. It was designed to give more information on properties and houses in the Syracuse area. So we did that for a little bit, but there's dozens of different startups that have come out of there.
Wasn't Dennis Crowley the guy that started Foursquare from there?
Yeah, he was a few years before me, and he came back while I was there. We did a bunch of new technology out of the Nexus Lab in the iSchool. And Dennis had a pretty big impact on that lab. And we used a lot of his APIs and some of the stuff that Foursquare was testing out. We took advantage of those in the lab to build some pretty cool tech.
Like, what did you build with the Foursquare tech?
Yeah. So one of the first things built in the lab was a gumball machine that would spit out gumballs anytime you checked in on Foursquare. So it was one of the guys was experimenting with the Arduino little PCs and he connected it up to the gumball machine. And then a couple of us were sort of playing around with the Foursquare API and he had had this this machine just you know, sitting in his house off campus at Syracuse. And he was like, I need something to do with it. So we plugged it into the Foursquare APIs. You would check in and you'd get your gumball. And for a lot of people, when they showed up at the lab, it was the first time they really could see this sort of nebulous idea of checking in somewhere. Or, you know, why would I have Foursquare? What would I do with it? And it was like, oh, well, you check in, you get a gumball. And it's like, oh, this makes sense now. I understand it.
Seeing that IoT crossover into the real world is usually mind-blowing for folks.
It is. And it's even better when you get candy out of it, too.
Yeah, you're like the monkey in the lab.
Yeah, trained to check in. Dennis loved it.
I like the idea of the iSchool. I guess I kind of informally did it. I was a business major, but had been programming since I was 11. And I always thought it was interesting that business and tech people couldn't talk to each other. You can make an entire career out of bridging that gap.
You could. Yeah. It's kind of what I did after the iSchool. It's such a big gap because you've got business people that are really good at setting strategy and thinking numbers and, you know, thinking what's the best outcome for the business. And then you've got tech people that don't know any of that, you know, a lot of the time. So it's, you know, how do we sort of build and run this really great product. But being able to sit at the middle and sort of have those conversations, not be sort of butting heads between teams, that's what I've been most excited about pursuing.
Now, you got to fool around with some other social media APIs during the 2012 election?
Yeah, we did. There was a whole class called Social Media in the Election that was also part of that same Nexus lab. And it was a lot of fun because we sort of started consuming the Twitter APIs. We had access not to the entire Twitter fire hose at that point, but we set up a bunch of servers to consume just massive quantities of tweets there. And the Social Media in the Election class was set up to run a fake mock election that was a couple of fake candidates that we had put together. And those candidates went through and they built their platforms and speeches and everything. They set up their social media and it was sort of beginning to end. And they had an actual election on campus at the end of that semester. But we had built the entire tech around it. So we had the social media listening. We had the analysis after. We had the real-time campaign war room set up with the big screens and the metrics of, you know, where everybody was tweeting and what the sentiment analysis was. And then we built a voting booth platform so that you could come in and it popped up the screen. We had some WebSocket set up. And so it was the real-time connection back to our secure voting database that was in some secret location on campus. And we had to set up a fake voting booth and you would come in, you'd pick out your candidate on the screen, tap it, it would go back in and it would tally the results in real time, but not too real time. So after you walked out of the voting booth, it would kind of give you a little bit of a delay so that it wasn't showing you your actual vote. But that was really exciting to people. That same sort of connection of tying back to the real world, you hit the button on the screen and you see your vote recorded. And I think it got a lot of people excited about participating in just the voting process in general.
That's cool. With all the snow up there, you must have done some skiing.
We did. There's for all the snow that's up in Syracuse, there aren't too many big ski mountains, but
Toggenberg's not a big ski mountain.
Yeah, I mean all 300 feet of vertical drop. That's yeah, it was a lot of fun. You got Toggenberg, you got a couple other ones up there, and it was a really good time. It's worth the 20-minute drive at 7 a.m. on a Sunday to get up and get yourself over the mountain to do some skiing.
So we went all the way out there in college. I went to UMass with some other snowboarders and we went out to Toggenberg for some sort of competition. I think it was like border cross type thing. And yeah, it was a long way to go for a short vertical drop.
Yeah, you drove right past Wachusett, which is probably three times the size.
Now, that's not the only thing you were involved in. You got in on the ambulance crew?
Actually met my wife while we were working on the ambulance together way back when. And I was involved in dispatching. And so they were just starting to use the computer-aided dispatch. They with some newer upgrades there. We had a bunch of different pieces involved in that. So we had our cards where you would run through and you would do your criteria for how to dispatch a call. And that was all pretty much pen and paper. And then you would enter it into the computer. And then they were just starting to upgrade that into a full computer process where you'd go through. But involved in dispatch, I got my EMT certification, involved in running calls and the whole nine yards.
You are listening to the Underserved Podcast. Underserved is produced by Syrinx, the developer-founded, developer-run software consulting company. For more information, visit syrinx.com. That's syrinx.com.
Now, this is an interesting coincidence because another guest from this season was also an EMT.
Oh, wow.
He was involved in the software industry, and he actually kind of boomeranged back there during COVID and was doing a bunch of testing and vaccinations and stuff. How did you even get involved in that, though? Is it like an interview process? Like, what happens?
There was an interview process, and I found out after I started that it was very competitive, and it was mostly med school students. It actually started because I was sitting in class with somebody that in the iSchool, and it was a pretty small group of iSchool people, and we all got to know each other, and he said, hey, you should try applying. You know, I'm working on the ambulance, and it's kind of a lot of fun, so you should just come down for interviews this weekend and give it a shot. I think you might think it's interesting. And I was like, don't you need medical experience? He goes, no, just try it. It's a great group of people. You'll really love them. It's a lot of fun. Just, you know, it's something to do. Give it a shot. He said, get a little bit dressed up, though. So I think a freshman or a sophomore in college, so I didn't have any dress stuff set up at school. So I think I had one palm tree tie, and I maybe had some slacks or something like that. And I showed up, and I walked in the door, and everybody else was waiting for their interviews, and they were dressed in almost full suits, and they were medical students, and they were preparing their notes. I was like, oh boy. I got in, I did my interview. I don't remember what we talked about, but it was a lot of fun. Left the interview, and they called me back a week later. They're like, we loved you. You're in. This is the best interview we've got. We love it when somebody isn't here just for their resume. They're here to sort of learn something new. They're here for new experiences, and they really want something that they can grow and do and not just check a box to get it done. And it was the best part of my college career.
There's so many times, especially when you're young, when you feel like I'm not good enough, my suit's not good enough, there's no way I'm going to clear this interview hurdle. You have imposter syndrome, whatever. And you know what? You try. And I remember in the pre-call you said, like, yeah, they felt I was one of the most authentic applicants.
Yeah, as long as you're somewhere for the right reasons and you're showing up, you know, you're on time and you're showing your true self. I think that's the most important part of any interaction, whether you're talking about a job interview or anything like that. Bring yourself and sort of own who you are, and that's the best way to go.
Now, I saw that your first job was Starship Nexus. All I could think of was like Blade Runner. What was it actually?
So Starship Nexus was that lab in Syracuse. So it was, I did some work through undergrad with them. And then after graduation, I stayed for a little bit to support some of the research they were doing. But it was a cool name for a lab that was doing all sorts of different stuff. It was a really fun place to be. And you could kind of try whatever you wanted to in the technical space and sort of, you know, look for opportunities to apply that to real world. And it ended up working out pretty well, especially as we were learning new things throughout.
And so what's your first real job out of school?
First real job out of school, actually, Scott got it for me. He helped me with Boston University, and I was a UI developer. And so a lot of the stuff that I'd been working on in Starship Nexus, building little apps and getting prototypes together, and then everything that I learned throughout the iSchool experience really set me up for that job. So we were working on the WordPress platform at Boston University, which powered every one of the production websites for the most part. There was a couple that hadn't migrated in yet, but at the time it was one of the largest higher ed WordPress installations in the country. And it was a great team to work with, really passionate developers. We had really good support from the organization, and then we were able to set some strong standards for, you know, how to successfully implement WordPress and how to have a really productive content and design development operation that scaled across the entire university.
Well, let's rewind a minute. What was the process of getting the job there?
So I reached out to Scott. I was looking for something that I was sort of debating whether or not to pursue the master's. So I was looking for something that wasn't quite full time. And it was kind of a weird situation where it wasn't part time, but it was like I wanted something that was most of the time with a little bit of time for coursework on the side. And Scott had a bunch of stuff for me. And he said, I think this would be a great fit. And so I did an interview. And we talked to the hiring manager, and he told me a little bit about what they were doing and what they were looking for. And it aligned so well to everything I'd been working on in the iSchool, just in terms of collecting business requirements and some of the basic nuts and bolts stuff. And in addition to being a developer and writing JavaScript and HTML and all that other stuff. So that's how I got that one.
Now, it sounds like, you know, you hit your first bigger organization in BU. You're probably like me. This is the first time you're working on a team and not moving stuff around in zip files and discovering build and release. What's that like?
It was definitely a little bit of a learning curve there. And to move from the small lab that I was working in with Nexus up to an entire enterprise and release process for code was a completely different way of thinking. But had some really strong developers there that were really great coaches and really helped me sort of understand my role in the process and understand sort of the reason that, you know, we needed to get all of our materials together for a change board meeting and get all of our, you know, lines of code signed off on by this enterprise change board. And then understand the risks of not being ready for the 1 a.m. to 6 a.m. change window where you could make your changes. And they helped me with that process. And we sort of talked through kind of where they were at relative to where the industry was at the time. And, you know, how do we sort of move forward from some of their legacy processes? So it was a great experience overall and a really strong learning experience for how do we sort of continually improve and not just sort of take the process as it exists today, but also be able to, you know, take it somewhere new.
So you get a LinkedIn inbound message one day saying, hey, let me tell you about this company, 5HD. What happens after that?
Yeah. So 5HD was an awesome company. It was a small agency outside of Canton. We did some work with them on different projects here and there, and then came on full time and was working as director of engineering over there, overseeing all the different projects that were going on. We worked for, you know, a number of different companies around the region. We did all sorts of stuff from campaign management and AdWords at the time, now Google Ads, through that sort of strategy, all the way through building websites and building campaign landing pages and that type of thing.
How do you start getting involved with Salesforce?
So at 5HD, we had started doing some Salesforce work for clients, started some implementation and design discovery, and found myself sort of really clicking with the way Salesforce approached technology and the way they were thinking about not just the solution as a technical platform, but really solving for some of the business user needs. And that's just started diving in from there, discovering, you know, all the different things that it offered and how it aligned towards the work we were doing on what they were calling Experience Cloud and Marketing Cloud and all the different pieces there to do marketing and delivery.
And you go to your first worldwide Salesforce conference there?
Yeah. So I went to my first Salesforce Days conference in Boston. And just to see everything come together and the passion around the platform, just couldn't believe sort of everything that was going on. It's got such a fanatic culture of people that are just really excited about coming together and sharing ideas. And what I saw at the conference was a lot of parallels to the work we had done in WordPress and sort of the same culture around just being excited about technology that people that were involved in WordPress. And it was fascinating to see the things that were possible with Salesforce. I mean, at that point, you know, we had done a little bit with marketing. We had done work with Experience Cloud. And, you know, I knew of it as a CRM, but to see it as sort of a platform for all of these new things was just completely mind-blowing and just got me really excited about leveraging it from there on.
Yeah, I mean, the business folks get excited about Salesforce too, because they see how quick it can be and how you don't need to be a developer to get most of the way there with most solutions. And that if you can put a little bit of development around it, you can really customize it. I remember they used to have like a repository of like off the shelf plugins you could enable in your instance. Is that still a big thing?
Yeah, there's the AppExchange, lets you download anything that's been created by developers and published out to the AppExchange. There's a review process that, you know, has to go through for any plugin that goes up there, but certainly something anybody can contribute to on the AppExchange. It's really easy for, you know, developers to sort of get started, get their idea out there and release it to everybody that has Salesforce. So it's easy to sort of get your app in front of a large number of people. You know, there's infinite number of customizations you can do. It's really a strong software development platform too. So if you look at a lot of the work that companies are doing now, they're leveraging Salesforce as their main stack in some cases. So if you look at marketing use cases, or you look at places where you might even consider React or something like that, you can look at some of the Salesforce languages and build your applications there instead. It's moving well beyond just core CRM, which is a really exciting time.
I am altering the scope of the project. Pray I don't alter it any further.
Excellent. Let the scope creep flow. Keep adding features. To deploy the release, deliver first. You must.
I find your lack of faith in change management disturbing.
Missing your deadline is the path to the dark side.
If you or someone you know manages software development projects, we can help. Call the offices of Syrinx Consulting. Syrinx provides software consultants who hit the ground running to help you deliver right away. Our toll-free number is 888-579-7469, option 1. Or you can live chat with Berg at Syrinx.com. That's Syrinx.com.
Syrinx is not a law office and this is not legal advice. Offer valid only in the United States. Hablamos español, pero solo un poco y no tener ni pies ni cabeza. Saludos.
I wonder if anyone's making money off the App Exchange, like selling their apps.
Yeah. So the App Exchange, there's a number of different models there. So you've got some companies that sort of put up their free app and then you have to subscribe to their service separately. And then there's other people that sell apps directly through App Exchange and they do a per user licensing. So there's a pretty big industry there. Yeah.
How do you get introduced to Publicis Sapient?
Yeah. So Publicis Sapient, there was an interesting LinkedIn post for a Salesforce architect position, and it reached out, and that's sort of how I got started on this journey here, was through that same LinkedIn thread.
What did you like about the company? You mentioned they had kind of two verticals that they were going after.
Yeah, so we've got a number of different verticals just on the Salesforce side. What was interesting to me about Publicis Sapient was thinking back to some of my high school days, really, because the Publicis Sapient culture is really a strong engineering background. So it's that idea of tinkering with things and that idea of sort of, you know, getting to the point where you're really thinking about how things work and how do you build things from the ground up and really solve challenges that businesses are facing and dive deeper than, you know, maybe the initial requirement. So help businesses look long term and really build the solutions that are the right fit for them. So that's what got me excited. The ability to work with sort of any number of different technologies. So I came in directly to the Salesforce Center of Excellence over there, but we've got strong expertise in Adobe and, you know, even outside other platforms as well. So a lot of Java background. So it's really a culture of engineers in combination with a culture of business. So it was a great fit.
See, I would think that there'd be some friction because Salesforce's kind of marketing thrust there for a while was like the word code with like the anti sign around it. But you told me about a phrase like no code, low code, pro code. How mm-hmm. do they kind of figure out who fits where?
Yeah, they're definitely thinking of their long-term strategy there. So they've certainly moved away from the no code as sort of the end-all, be-all, and they're moving more towards that tiered structure. And so it's fascinating to see it evolve because you do have a lot of that conflict that sort of evolves. So it's like, you know, when do I do something on the platform with just configuration and do it through some checkboxes? And when do I let the business users make that decision that they can just turn this field on and off? And when is that maybe not the right decision? You know, when we need more control over it and more approvals or consistency and sort of not letting anybody make that change in the interface. So you balance things through that tiered structure there, and the no-code approach is a really quick way to get small apps out the door and sort of build quick MVPs or build applications that don't need that custom level of development. But the low-code is, you know, maybe something, one of the areas in Salesforce that it's common is Salesforce flows, which sort of let you take an action and do a bunch of other steps following that and have that be an automated process. So at that point, it might be something that the business user configures and they get their flow ready, they publish it, and that's released out to the org. And then maybe that's sort of supplemented with different areas of smaller pieces of code. So, you know, they can put in a form, but it doesn't quite do the thing that they needed to do. They need a certain validation on the addresses or something like that, or they need to pull in the Google Places API to pre-fill somebody's address. And so maybe that's a form that the users put in, and then the developers come in and add a little bit of customization to it. That's kind of that low code option. And then the pro code is where it's completely done by a developer. So it goes through a full build release process. You kind of think about the CI and the build and all that, those other things that you typically do, but it goes into the same Salesforce platform. So you could build a little widget that the business user could then drop onto the page, which is a completely custom code widget, but it also combines it with the ability for the business user to customize. So it's been a great evolution.
Now, I remember way back in the day, I'm dating myself here with like Siebel CRM, that the more you customized it, the more you risked your upgrade path, that you could kind of paint yourself into a corner if you got too heavy into the customization. Is the idea still like, let's use the least amount of code possible to get the job done in order to preserve the upgrade path, or is that less of a concern these days?
So it's less of a concern these days, and Salesforce has abstracted a lot of the underlying work there through APIs. So if you look at something like building a Lightning component or some custom code on the platform, most of the time you'll be leveraging APIs that Salesforce has for accessing different pieces of the organization and calls out to get the business data. So those APIs, they protect pretty heavily so that those don't break between releases and that type of thing. And they've done a great job of sort of communicating releases really clearly and, you know, upcoming changes and any, you know, schema changes that need to be done. So certainly it's something to be aware of, but a lot of the custom development happens separately from the business configuration. So those tie-ins don't typically break between releases.
Is that where you're using the Apex coding language, or what are you using to develop there?
Yeah, so it really depends on what you're looking for. So the Apex is sort of the back end. If you think of the equivalent of like a Java or something like that, that's where you'll be using Apex. The Apex language is built in combination with all those APIs and all those direct accesses into your org's data. That's your backend language. Your frontend language typically had been Visual Forest or something in the past. And most of the frontend language now is Lightning Web Components, which are most similar to like a React or Angular.
And what about like CDP and CPQ? Are you seeing a lot of customers implementing these, getting a lot of value out of them?
Yeah, so there's a ton of interest in CDP, and there's momentum around it too. So the value in business data is being able to unlock that data about your customers and be able to make those connections and understand your data. And that's where CDP comes into play. And CPQ is a huge market. So being able to leverage CPQ for your business is something that a lot of organizations are doing to optimize their processes, especially as you start to think about, you know, how do you take some businesses that are still doing offline processes for some of those things, pulling it into CPQ, it's a huge challenge for them. So it's a little bit outside of my wheelhouse on the CPQ side, but certainly a big area.
And you do any work with Commerce Cloud?
Yeah, so Sapient does. I don't do work directly with Commerce Cloud, but I know we have a pretty significant Commerce Cloud team, yeah.
It seems like Salesforce, kind of like Microsoft, is embracing more open standards instead of proprietary languages to do different pieces. Would you say that's a fair assumption these days?
Yeah. So if you look at the work they've done with Lightning Components, that's actually been open sourced as a language. So the Lightning Component language is open source, runs on any platform. And they're more and more moving that direction because they see the limits of some of the proprietary languages. So it's great to see that moving more towards open source.
Yeah, you can run that straight up on AWS without even having a Salesforce instance, right?
Yeah, so LWC, you can run, you know, anywhere you could run Angular, React. So it's a great front-end language. Apex itself can only be run on Salesforce, but you're seeing more tie-ins there with Heroku and with some off-platform areas. So it's great to, see new ways that you're able to leverage your Salesforce.
Now, with GDPR and cookie management and privacy concerns, a lot of folks are freaking out. They're not going to have their cookies. How do you kind of move beyond that?
Yeah, I think cookies is a huge moment of panic for the industry. But I think what you're seeing now is a big shift towards more authentic consumer experiences. And so the ability for cookies to track somebody across multiple websites, that third-party cookie is what we're seeing get deprecated. I don't think, you know, we're going to see first-party cookies go anywhere anytime. So I think that's where brands are leaning in is, you know, how do we make that connection so that consumers want to give us their data? I think more and more you get people realizing that you either are the product or you're paying for the product. And so if brands can really show that value exchange and they can say, you know, here's why you should give us your data and here's what we're going to do for you, whether that's, you know, maybe somebody's looking to personalize their experience. You know, if I'm visiting Zappos and I'm, you know, I tell them that I'm a guy that's interested in white sneakers, you know, that's something that they might use for their marketing, but I also get some nice white sneakers out of it, right? I can get to their site and I can find exactly what I'm looking for quickly. And that's the value exchange for me that, you know, I'm comfortable giving that data and they're comfortable sort of, you know, using that for marketing. So I could sort of, you know, understand what they're doing with that behind the scenes.
There's times I feel like, oh, this is great. They know what I want. I'm actually getting an ad served up to me. Like I buy stuff from B&H Photo all the time for like the video and audio gear here. And, you know, I'll get a banner ad somewhere that'll have like some product. I'm like, ooh, that's actually a great idea. We need one of those. And then other times, like I'll swear I was just talking or thinking about something and then they're feeding me an ad. It just feels creepy.
Yeah.
How do you adjust the slider?
It's definitely a balance. So I think you've got, you know, companies that do it really well and sort of they lean more into the preferences that you've sort of explicitly given them. And then there's companies that go in and sort of buy a bunch of data and sort of are using broad segments that are available from Facebook or something like that. And they're not really approaching that strategy very respectfully. Or even efficiently, if you're talking about a dollars and cents point, you know, I think it really starts with, you know, how do we make marketing not creepy starts with, you know, that value of making sure our customers sort of understand, you know, what we're doing with their data and creating that experience where they, you know, visiting B&H Photo and them understanding you and you understanding, you know, what you're looking for from them. I think that's where that sort of goes back to.
Are there any mentors along the way, all the way back to university or through one of your jobs in your career that were kind of formative for you?
Yeah, I think it's always important to find strong mentors. And, you know, while I was at the university, there was a couple people that ran the Starship Nexus that were just really inspirational in terms of setting that sort of vision for the future. So professors from there really helped me sort of reach for the stars, kind of a bad pun, I guess, with the Nexus there. But, you know, really be able to sort of see beyond, you know, sort of the way things are now and to what they could be. And then starting at BU to see some of the developers and some of their processes for how do you really solve for some big challenges, you know, at the university of you know, being able to release code to millions of people on a front-end website that affects the entire university. Really inspirational and sort of continuing on that software development process for me.
How about advocacy, philanthropy, anything that you're interested in or passionate about?
Yeah, I'm really passionate about the PanMass Challenge. Been involved with that for over 15 years now. So it's I started when I was really young, when my dad had been riding in it forever. And it's a fantastic organization that just continues to grow and grow every year. And so I'm not riding in it anymore. I do the road crew now, which is the medical support for that we do mechanical and medical support for the ride. But it's a fantastic organization.
When you rode, were you doing like the segments or the whole boat or?
Yeah. So my dad and I rode, we did the Wellesley to Bourne and then back to Wellesley loop. And we did that for a couple years. I had to work my way up to that though. I think that was a 290-mile segments. So over 2 days. And so I started with 1 day with him. I think we did a small loop the very first year and then I worked our way up to Bourne to Wellesley, which was the 90 miles.
That's a lot of biking.
It is. Yeah. Once you get over 3-4 hours in the bike there, it's just sort of muscle memory and you just keep going, keep drinking the water and eating the kind bars.
A couple of my in-laws have been involved in it the last several years. They've done a lot of fundraising. I think it's a great cause. I think it's great that you've been able to take your EMT experience and full circle, maybe instead of helping one person at a time on an ambulance call, being able to help hundreds of people a day finish the PanMass Challenge and hopefully help find a cure for cancer.
It's a fantastic ride and love being a part of it.
Any hobbies you're into? You still doing any skiing?
Yeah, so we go up to Vermont, sometimes up to Killington, and there's a little mountain next to Killington called Pico that's just a lot of fun. So I do skiing, not as much biking anymore. I got to get back into that one of these days and get back into shape. But yeah, I think we just moved into a house a couple of years ago. So just, you know, the house just takes so much of your time keeping it busy.
Yeah, it's like having another job.
It is. It really is.
Yeah, a bunch of my dry cleaning and suits seem to have gotten smaller during COVID somehow, just hanging on their hangers in the closet. So I might have to do some biking too.
I know. Yeah, it's that COVID got all of us with the just...
It's a hard one to work off.
Yeah, it's easy to put them on. It's a lot harder to take them off.
Amen. Andrew, thank you so much for joining us today and sharing with the listeners of Underserved your experiences.
Thanks so much for having me, Andrew. It's been great.
And we'll talk to everyone soon on the next episode of Underserved.
Thank you for listening to the Underserved podcast. For more information on the topics discussed and for show notes, visit the show website, underserved.fm. And please be sure to rate, like, and subscribe to Underserved on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts.